5. Overpopulation, 1990 to 1995. Bob Odenkirk, writer. Chris Farley was like a child. He was like an 8-year-old. One time, when he was fucking rip-roaring drunk in Chicago, he was tossing furniture around his apartment, actually picking it up and throwing it like 10 feet. It was scary, man. Then, all of a sudden, he turned to me and said, with complete innocence, "Do you think Belushi's in heaven?" I didn't know what to say. Saturday Night Live was growing older and younger at the same time, entering the third decade of its existence with a few cast members who were even wetter behind the ears than the founders had been. While some of the new comedy struck longtime SNL loyalists as juvenile, the negative adjective most often applied to the show in the 90s, new generations drawn to SNL loved the humor and identified with the younger cast members. The SNL audience has always felt protective toward the show and concerned about its possibly becoming tamer, less impudent, less willing to take risks. And from the earliest episodes, Michaels made the show a regular topic of the show. Criticisms were addressed and lampooned on the air. In a lavish and complex production number that opened a December 1991 show hosted by Steve Martin, the cast ridiculed both itself and the idea that the show was growing soft. Martin sang that instead of just going through the motions or phoning it in, tonight was the night I'm actually gonna try and do the best I can for a change. As he led the singing cast through the studio, the number was a parody of the title song from the old movie musical Babes in Arms, Martin came upon Michaels, who, spoofing his own image, was having his portrait painted and getting a manicure, barely involved in the program, looking aloof and effete. Saturday Night Live diffused criticisms of itself by turning them into comedy. But as the decade wore on, jokes wouldn't be enough to placate all the critics, especially those high up in the ranks of network management. To one of its noblest traditions, the show remained conspicuously true, discovering and showcasing comic talent that might otherwise never have come to the nation's attention. Some of those who joined the cast in the 90s and had first watched the show in high school looked to Eddie Murphy as their ultimate SNL role model, rather than to members of the original cast, that comedy Mount Rushmore of Chase, Belushi, Radner, Aykroyd. Chris Farley was the exception. Belushi was his hero, his obsession, and he tried to pattern his personal and professional life after the wild Albanians, the best and, alas, worst of it. Like Belushi, Farley demonstrated amazing physical agility for someone of considerable heft and girth. It isn't easy to be elfin when you weigh 300 pounds, but Farley brought it off. Sadly, things he turned out to have in common with his idol included not only prodigious talent, but an array of beckoning demons. And as with Belushi, the demons proved deadly. Adam Sandler, cast member. Farley was a whole other level. It was not even a question of who we all loved and thought was the funniest. When he walked into the room, that was it. Lorne Michaels, executive producer. As a kid, Chris had taped his eyebrow up to try and look like Belushi. We often said Chris was the child John and Danny never had, but would have had if they'd had a child. Chevy came to see Chris once, and Chris was doing his falls, and Chevy said, "Don't you use anything to break your fall?" Chris said, "What do you mean? Did you?" Chris had welts all over his chest. He just assumed that that was the price you paid for doing it. Fred Wolf, writer. I was in such awe of Chevy, and I know Farley was too. Chevy was very nice to Farley, and Farley would sort of sit at his feet and listen to him talk. Because Farley was physical, Chevy was physical, and Chevy was telling Farley that he was worried about him throwing out his back, or getting into the same problems that Chevy got into because of his physicality. Chevy would talk to Farley and be very nice to him, and Farley just loved it. Farley looked at Lorne as the ruling patriarch. He goofed off to get his attention, and then, when he got his attention and was chastised for it, he would be quiet for days, then furious at him. Chris got away with a lot because he was a really likable guy. David Spade, cast member. Chris was my best friend in the cast. I was close to Adam Sandler and Chris Rock, too, but Chris and I always had a real good time together. Tommy Boy was Lauren's idea to make something based on how we are in real life, how we fight, how we laugh, and how we act. So we tried to make a movie to reflect a little of that. It was great. We used to make fun of Chris at table reads. We were like, are you ripping off Belushi in this one or just Aykroyd? Because he liked those guys so much that he would incorporate them. He wore Belushi's pants from wardrobe if he could find any, and sometimes he wore two pairs of pants, which I don't even know how to explain. I used to get stuff that had old cast members' names in them, but when his said Belushi, he loved that. He would keep those, he'd wear them. Chris looked up to Belushi as the king. My argument was that I actually thought he was funnier than Belushi, and he wouldn't accept that. Then when I would get pissed at him, I would say, was Belushi trying to be like anybody? No, he just did whatever the funniest thing that he could think of was. You're hysterical on your own. You don't need any of that. Don't try to be like him. Don't even look up to him. We all think Belushi is great, but you are fine on your own. And I thought that angle might get to him, that Belushi didn't try to copy anybody or be like anybody or look up to anybody, so why should he? It didn't work. Jack Handy, writer. Farley was such a sweetheart. He would come off stage after being in one of my sketches and put his hands together in a sort of prayerful motion toward me and go, was that okay? Was that okay? I remember one time we went to Tom Davis's wedding at some resort in upstate New York. The resort had a bowling alley. In front of everyone, Farley would just throw his body out parallel to the lane and land from about a 3-foot straight parallel drop to the bowling lane as a joke. That's the kind of stuff he would do all the time. Fred Wolfe. Farley and this girl on the show were going out. She was really smart and pretty, and Farley really liked her a lot. But she couldn't put up with any more of Farley's stuff, so they broke up. And then she started dating Steve Martin. So one day Farley comes to me and he says, Fred, I hear that she's going out with some guy. What can you tell me about it? And, you know, nobody wanted to tell Chris Farley that she was dating anyone else, particularly Steve Martin. So I just said, well, I haven't heard. I don't know. And he goes, I know she's seeing somebody. You've got to tell me who it is. And I said, well, I don't want to get in the middle of any of that kind of stuff. And Farley said, well, she may find somebody better looking than me, or she might find somebody richer than me, but she's not going to find anybody funnier than me. And what I couldn't tell him was, he was wrong on all three counts. He had hit the hat trick of failure. Steve Martin was richer, better looking, and even funnier. Chris Rock, cast member. He was my man. I loved Chris. He was one of the funniest guys. Not competitive at all. We all knew he was funnier than us, and it was totally acceptable. He would try to break me up on the air. He broke Spade up a lot. You have to watch the sketches. Farley had no qualms running around naked. That wasn't a big thing to him. I probably saw his dick more than his girlfriend did.
Molly Shannon, cast member. I had some rituals before shows. Mostly I would pray. I'd say a little prayer. And Chris Farley did that too. I saw him once. It was so sweet. He'd kneel down and bless himself in his dressing room before every show. I peeked in one night and saw him, and I thought, that's sweet. He was a very religious Catholic man. He was very Catholic. I was raised Catholic, too. Lauren loves Irish Catholics. I don't know why, but he really does seem to like Irish Catholics a lot.
Fred Wolfe. Farley once stuck his ass out the window of the 17th floor at 30 Rock and took a shit. Another time, in front of 20 or 25 people in a very crowded writer's room, mixed company, women, men, Farley came in naked. He has his dick tucked between his legs, and he was doing Jamie Gumm from Silence of the Lambs. He took a golf club and shoved it about 3 inches up his ass, then pulled the golf club out and started licking it. David Spade. That Chippendales sketch where Patrick Swayze and Chris danced with their shirts off became pretty well known. It was early on when we all thought you had to do whatever was asked of you. Chris took off his shirt then because he's a fat guy and it is funny, and that was really part of the sketch. But I think later on he didn't want to do that as much. Like most actresses, they'll do the Cinemax movie, but then after that they keep the shirt on. Kevin Nealon, cast member. Most of those guys who came in, Farley, Spade, Rock, and Sandler, were much younger than the rest of us. It was almost like they were our teenage sons. All their offices were clustered together way down the hall, and when you would go back there, the offices were messy with Playboy magazines strung everywhere, and they'd be talking about what kind of action they got the night before with some model. But it was fun having them around. Those guys probably knew Farley better than I did. He was always loud and acting up, and one time I caught his eye and said, "Take it down a notch." So after that, if I'd look down at him, he'd go, "Take it down a notch." I got to know his family. We had Mother's Day specials 2 years in a row, and he brought on his mother and his family, all great people. I think Chris just wanted to make people laugh. He wanted to make sure that he was funny. He always felt he had to be funny. That was his torture. Al Franken, writer. It got to be when cast members and new people came in, they sort of had this template to go by, which is do the show, become a star on the show, get movies, and become Eddie Murphy. And the problem was many of the cast members that came in thought that would be their arc, and many of the people who came into the show thought it was sort of chapter two or chapter one in the incredible career of them. Like, this is manifest destiny. This is meant to happen. I am Eddie Murphy. And the worst of that was the attitude, "Get out of the way, old man," to any of us who'd been there a while, instead of, "I want to learn something." Now, Farley was not that way. Farley revered the show. And with anyone who had any contact with the old show, he just wanted to sit and listen. John Lovitz, cast member. I was in California, and Brad Gray calls me and said, "Lorne called and said they're doing something on the show, and it's just a joke, and they love you." I said, "Oh, all right." So I watched the show that night, and it's a cold opening, and Lorne says, "You're really leaving, huh?" And Dennis goes, "Yes." And then Lorne says, "You're not going to keep coming back like Lovitz, are you? It's pathetic." I was, like, really hurt. I was like, "You asshole." And the audience didn't laugh. It bombed, but I was really pissed. And I was like, "Fuck them, I'm not going back." I thought it was really shitty, because they kept asking me to come back. And then after that, they still asked me to come back. Lorne goes, "Oh, it's just a joke." I go, "Oh, what's funny?" It didn't seem funny to me, and the audience didn't laugh. It was really mean-spirited. Worried about losing cast members to the movies or primetime television, Michaels overstocked the show and in the process proved that there can be too much of a good thing. A cast so large was bound to be fractious, with the competition for airtime fever-pitched. The SNL troupe of the early 90s tended to split along generational lines, with Sandler, Farley, and Rock, the new boys, pitted against veterans like Carvey, Hartman, Nealon, and Franken. Mike Myers sort of straddled the field, prepping for his own film career. The show was turning another corner. Baby boomers who'd grown up with it were becoming less demographically desirable to advertisers. As the decade progressed, Michaels relied more and more on young, hot stars to host the show and lure younger audiences, knowing that viewers who'd been with SNL from the beginning might never have heard of them, but that their kids—yes, now they had kids—probably had. It was a time of less than subtle humor, but often huge laughs. Chris Rock. I've been friends with Adam 16, 17 years, since I started stand-up. I was a young comedian, and he was a young comedian, but also in college. He was going to NYU. I was doing some movie, hanging with the homeboys, and they wanted to meet with me. And little-known fact, Lorne Michaels makes you wait 2-3 hours to see him. There's many a funny comedian that couldn't wait. None of them are very successful now that I know of, so I waited. We auditioned the same night. There were all these great character guys ahead of us, and we felt really inferior. We didn't know why we were there. I didn't even wait around to meet Lorne after the audition, because I knew I wasn't going to get it. I guess Farley auditioned the same night, too, but he auditioned at Second City. I got to audition, and then I stuck around and saw Adam's audition. We passed, we got hired. And I remember years later I asked Lorne why he'd hired us, because I didn't do any voices, anything particular that would help me on SNL. And Lorne said, "The reason I hired you guys was original thought." He said, "Anybody can do impressions, like my uncle does impressions." And I said, "Okay, good compliment." And when I did casting for my show, I kept that in mind, the original thought thing. Adam Sandler. I was in, I think, sixth grade when Saturday Night Live was the biggest thing. I'm sure the other guys who were my age probably said this too, but my big thing was trying to stay up to watch it. In the schoolyard, the cooler kids were talking about the bees, and they talked about Belushi a lot, and I wanted to be part of that conversation. So I tried to stay up, and I'd make it to 11 o'clock, and I was very excited. All I had to get through was the news, and I'd usually get to about 11:20 and fall asleep. And then my brother would be carrying me to my room, and while he was carrying me, I'd be like, "Is it on? Is the show on?" He'd say, "Yeah, yeah, don't worry, go to sleep. I'll tell you about it tomorrow." And so he would tell me what happened on Sunday mornings, and then I would bullshit in the playground and pretend I saw the show also. I loved Aykroyd. I loved Belushi. I loved Bill Murray. I loved Chevy. I think the reason I loved Caddyshack so much growing up is that all my favorite guys were in the movie together. No matter who they cut to, I love that guy. I love him too. The hosts back then were cool. Like when Reggie Jackson hosted, I was a huge Yankee fan. That was as cool as it got. The show was a major part of the life of every one of the kids I grew up with. It was not only topical because it dealt with current events, it was just like instilled in our heads. These are the funniest guys of our generation, so whatever they say is funny is funny. Tim Herlihy, writer. Adam Sandler was my college roommate at NYU. He decided he wanted to do stand-up in his sophomore year, so I just helped him out. We all kind of helped him out with some material. I started doing it more and more as his school progressed. I always figured that he would be successful. We both graduated, and then he went out to L.A. after graduation, and I stayed in New York and actually went to NYU Law School. When he got the job at SNL, I kind of helped him out. And then he got me a tryout in the spring of 94. David Spade. I remember there was a period when the cast members were bigger stars than the hosts. That was scary. I was thinking Mike Myers is a bigger star than the host, and Dana Carvey is a bigger star than the host. It was weird. After they left, it got back to normal, where the cast was all evened out and the hosts were bigger names. When I got there, they were saying that Dennis Miller and Dana and Phil were horrible. That was a horrible cast. And then in a couple of years, when I moved up into the cast, they said we were horrible. Why can't we be like Dana and Phil and those guys, back when it was good? And then when we left, they were telling Will Ferrell that when Spade, Farley, and Sandler were there, that's when it was funny.
Julia Sweeney, cast member. I came from the Groundlings. I was performing there for a few years, and I think it seemed like every week an increasingly more important person from SNL would come and watch. And then, in the end, it came down between me and Lisa Kudrow. And so Lorne came, and we did, like, a showcase for me and Lisa. We each got to do 3 sketches, and I ended up getting chosen. And I remember thinking afterward, I hope Lisa does okay. Lisa Kudrow, host. Thank God I didn't get Saturday Night Live. I had met Lorraine Newman at the Groundlings, and she let me know that she thought I was really funny and really good. So she called Lorne Michaels and said he should really look at me. Then I found out they were also going to look at Julia Sweeney. Julia and I got to be friends over this. I remember us being on the phone and talking about what a crazy, hideous situation this was for us. There was going to be one show that we were going to do, and based on that one show, a big chunk of our career was going to be decided. So Lorne came out with Marcy Klein, the talent coordinator, and there was one night set aside at the Groundlings for them to look at Julia Sweeney and myself. Julia had a lot of people in the audience. I had some friends in the audience. I even had some good friends who were writers on the show. Conan O'Brien was writing on the show, and I asked him if he could be in the audience. He actually thought that wouldn't look so good. So I just thought, yeah, the classier route is not to stack the audience. I don't think I did my best, and rightly so they picked Julia. There have been a couple things that I didn't get or got fired from, where friends of mine who had a little more experience said, "It's always a blessing when a door closes, because another door is going to open." And there's no such thing as your whole career being decided in one night. I just kept believing that I was being saved by not doing Saturday Night Live to do something else. Julia Sweeney. I felt really accepted and encouraged and appreciated right away. In some ways, my trajectory was the opposite of other people's, who probably were more successful there in the end. My first show was Jimmy Smith's, and I did a sketch with Jimmy right after the update spot, which is like an important sketch spot. And so I felt like I came in with a bang. I didn't come in and hang out and only do teeny parts and sketches waiting until I could get a bigger part. So that was really encouraging for me. Lauren had wisely paired me up in an office with Christine Zander, and we hit it off immediately. She had been there a few years and knew how to navigate herself around politically there. So the beginning was really great.
Adam Sandler. It helped my whole career when I went from a stand-up comedian who would write maybe a couple of jokes a week that I would be excited about to, I think I was 23 when I got on the show. All of a sudden, writing a few skits a week and helping other guys out with their ideas and trying to do jokes for their skits. All of a sudden, I thought about writing more. I thought about what really makes me laugh. Fred Wolf. My little group that came up on that Saturday Night Live were Dana Carvey, Kevin Nealon, Adam Sandler, Rob Schneider, David Spade, and Dennis Miller. It was a giant cast. The first time I was there, I was writing for the guys who were featured players who weren't really getting on the air as much as maybe they'd want to. And so I concentrated on writing for Schneider, Spade, Adam Sandler, and, you know, whenever I could, I'd throw some stuff everyone else's way, too. But I mainly wrote with those guys. And then, when Norm MacDonald was at it, he was another friend of mine, and so I wrote with him and for him also. David Mandel, writer. I was in the Lampoon, and between my junior and senior year, we did a project down at Comedy Central, which was called MTV, Give Me Back My Life. It was a fake 10-year anniversary documentary for MTV, and Al Franken was an advisor to it. And the following summer, Al and a guy named Billy Kimball and a couple of the executives from Comedy Central, who had been on the show that I worked for on the Lampoon, went on to do the comedy coverage of the Democratic and Republican conventions. And they all remembered me and hired me back. So I went and worked on that. I spent all summer doing the Democratic and Republican stuff with Al, and at the end of the summer, he basically said, "You're funny. I'm going to talk to Jim and Lauren and get you on Saturday Night Live," which was perhaps one of the great moments of my life. Tim Meadows, cast member. A well-written sketch is basically anything by Jack Handy or Robert Smigel. Those guys write sketches that are refreshing to watch and different takes on the subjects or comic premise. It's original. Bob Odenkirk. I would like to state for the record that Robert Smigel saved sketch comedy in America. I think he was the best sketch writer in America for like that 10-year period, his first 10 years there. And as great as Jim Downey is, and as pure as he is, I think Robert was really hitting his stride and, you know, doing amazing things. Everything from a McLaughlin group to the James Kirk sketch to a lot of Perot stuff to so much great stuff. Like that opening where Steve Martin sings, "I'm not gonna phone it in tonight." Smigel, I mean, just genius work. Solid, amazing, brilliant, and smart. Partly because it really is a live show and not live on tape like The Tonight Show or Late Show with David Letterman, SNL has a history filled with surprises, shocks, major and minor calamities, and most of all, controversies. But all of the show's dust-ups were trifling compared to the brouhaha that erupted in September 1992. In a gesture that had not been rehearsed nor revealed to anyone on the show's staff in advance, singer Sinead O'Connor ended a haunting a cappella rendition of a modern protest ballad by tearing up a photograph of the Pope on the air, thus indicating the song had really been an attack on him and the Catholic Church. That turned out to be haunting too, but in the worst way. John Zonars, music coordinator. I was in the control booth. I was the one who basically put the whole thing together, unfortunately. Essentially what happened was she was performing on the show with an orchestra on the first song she was doing, and the second song was a selection from a record that she had done a cappella. We rehearsed it that way on Thursday. Everything was all fine and well, and we got through it. She refused to tape a promo, which we all thought was really rude. And that was a difficult thing to handle, actually, at the time. On Thursday afternoons, we always taped the promos, and Lorne was actually coming in and producing. These days, the writers do it. But she refused to do it and left in a huff. And there was sort of blame cast around for that, which I was involved in. Anyhow, I didn't think much of it until Saturday afternoon when they came in to do their audio balance at 5:30, they meaning the band and Sinead and her manager at the time, who I think has passed away. They came in, and the manager cornered me and asked me a very poignant question, which was, "When something goes wrong on the air, do you use the dress rehearsal performance?" I said to him, "It's been known to happen for the West Coast, but for the live show, it's obviously live. It goes out live, I think as far as, like, the Central Time Zone." So then he said, "I want to change the second song to War by Bob Marley, and she'll do it a cappella. And there's a very special thing she wants to do, since War is essentially about child abuse. At the end of the song, she wants to hold up a photo of a child and make a statement about child abuse, okay?" So I went as far as to get her the photo of a child, talked to Lorne about it, talked to the director, basically tell him he's got to zoom in on her and get a close-up of her with this photo. And when we did the dress rehearsal, she sang War and held up the photo of the child, and I think she said, "This is what we have to protect," or something. The house was captivated. She's giving this exhilarating performance by herself. And then, during the actual show, I remember I was in the studio watching her, and I started feeling nervous, and I thought that my nerves were due to the fact that since she was doing it a cappella, she was taking longer than she had at dress, and I was afraid that she was taking too much time. So I walked into the control room, and just as I did, it happened. And I looked up at everybody, and they were all in shock, and they refused to turn on the applause sign after she ripped up the picture of the Pope. And I think that was the classiest move in the whole history of television, not cueing applause. And then everybody was basically just in shock, except for Lorne. Lorne was the only one that didn't seem like completely out of his mind. One thing I've always respected about Lorne is that he has this real hard-on for any kind of censorship. He does not want anything to be censored. He wants things to happen as they happen. The big issue at that point was, does she go on for the good nights? Does she get up there and say goodbye with everybody like a legitimate cast member? And Lorne decided that she should, which is a decision that he got fucked for afterwards, but I'm sure he would stand by today. Because there she was, she went out and she did something extraordinary, and blasphemous in some people's eyes, but he was able to maintain some kind of respect for her, some kind of respect for the whole process of the show by letting her do that. Lorne Michaels. I didn't know it was coming. Here's what I think was happening that week, which was the other story. Tim Robbins, whose film Bob Roberts we first ran as a short, like a 3-minute film in the 85 season, was the host and had written a piece about GE dumping PCBs into a river, which we had all heard at read-through. The sentiments behind it were heartfelt, but it didn't work as comedy. It didn't get picked because it didn't play. And I think Tim was fearful that I might be under some sort of GE thing, that I was not going to allow that to happen. So after one of the musical intros, he wanted to wear a T-shirt that had a GE logo with a bar across it. And I said, "Be my guest, you know?" I don't think that General Electric, which by then owned NBC, of course, will suddenly grind to a halt because of this. Saturday Night Live is its own thing. It has its own sort of beliefs and standards, or whatever. What everybody forgets is that music wasn't the closing thing. There's an act after it. So now, after Sinead tears up the picture, we have to go do a comedy act. Well, there's complete silence in the studio when it happens. The switchboard's lighting up, but we're not anywhere near the switchboard. We're just getting ready for the next sketch, which we know is not going to play. I was stunned, but not as much as the guy from the audience who was trying to charge her and destroy the show while she was singing. He had to be taken away by security. Now there's silence, and we've got to do a sketch. The sketch unravels. But now Tim Robbins has got to come out and stand beside her for good nights. It wasn't like somebody holding up her LP. Of course, saying LP dates me now. What I'm saying is it wasn't promotional. I think Tim Robbins was wearing the anti-GE t-shirt. For him, that would have been an enormously big statement, to be defying a corporation while you're on it. And that was sort of the revolution that was going on that week. That was what people were focused on. People at the network were very focused on what Tim Robbins was going to do about GE. And I was less so, because I have more confidence in GE. But there's a lot of people whose job it is to anticipate trouble, and they were all on the Tim Robbins issue. And suddenly this girl tears up a picture of the Pope. When she did the Dylan concert the next week at the Garden, they booed her. I don't think she understood the scale of what she was doing. It was martyrdom. We didn't quite get what it was. Warren Littlefield, NBC executive. All in all, even when it was, "Oh my God, Sinead O'Connor tore up a picture of the Pope," as I said to Lorne, "Lorne, when we go too long without controversy, something's wrong. This show is supposed to rock. It's supposed to be the adolescent that's not obedient to authority. And if we lose that, then we don't have that show." Lorne Michaels. I think it was the bravest possible thing she could do. She'd been a nun. To her, the church symbolized everything that was bad about growing up in Ireland, the way she grew up in Ireland, and so she was making a strong political statement. Rick Ludwin, NBC Vice President for Late Night. That was truly a Danny Thomas spit-take moment on my part. I jumped out of my chair. I was in Burbank watching the live feed in my office. I just knew we were in trouble. Dave Wilson, Director. It was a little unnerving. I was more upset that she had hidden it from us than I was by the act itself. In rehearsal, her manager had asked if we could use only one camera because of the type of song it was. They would like it not interrupted with intercutting. And then he asked if she could hold up a picture of starving children, and that's what she did at rehearsal. It was a very tender moment, actually. And then, to change it all into this whole Pope thing, I think everybody felt they had really been railroaded. I was angry. I made sure that nobody pushed the applause button, so we went out on a quiet studio. I gave the order. Lenny Pickett, band leader. Things like the Sinead O'Connor incident have happened from time to time. Somebody's done something outrageous, and I hate to say this, but it's kind of more delightful than anything else, to see something that amazing on live television. It's what everybody secretly is waiting for. That's why it's still an interesting show after all these years, because people know anything might go down. And when it does, it's exhilarating as much as anything else. I mean, it's not like you want to see those sorts of things, but at the same time, when they do happen, you're aware that you were just participating in an event. And to know that there's always a potential for that to occur is sort of wonderful. Once that uproar subsided, Saturday Night Live returned to its version of normal, concentrating on comedy. Michaels was coming under increasing pressure from the network to churn out recurring characters that would bring the audience back week after week, and maybe, potentially, be spun off into NBC sitcoms of their own. That turned out to be only a bean counter's pipe dream, though some SNL cast members have wandered off into primetime sitcoms after leaving the show.
Julia Sweeney. I did the character Pat at the Groundlings, and it was part of my audition for Saturday Night Live. I'd been an accountant for like 5 years, and there was one person I worked with in particular who had a lot of mannerisms like Pat. This person sort of drooled and had the kind of body language of Pat. I started trying to do him. I was testing it out on my friends, and they were just like, yeah, it's good, but it doesn't seem like a guy that much. Like, I couldn't quite pull off being in drag convincingly enough. So then I thought, maybe that's the joke. I'll just have one joke in here about how we don't know if that's a man or a woman, just to sort of cover up for my lack of ability to really play a guy convincingly. I think it was like the Christmas show or something, a John Goodman show. I put it up with Kevin Nealon in it. Just showing how humble I was about that sketch, I didn't even cast the host opposite me. I just thought, well, maybe the host needs a break. And they put it on as the very last sketch of the show, and I didn't think it got that great a response. I felt it was just okay. I felt happy with it, but it wasn't like, oh, new recurring character, even. And the audience responded, but I think they were also really confused by it, or creeped out by it. A couple weeks later, though, Roseanne hosted, and she had seen that show, and she said, oh my God, we've got to do that character! And I said, oh, okay. So Christine and I wrote a Pat sketch for Roseanne and I to do, and when I came on during the sketch, I got like this fabulous entrance applause, as if the audience knew the character. That was actually one of the most beautiful moments in my life. And it was completely unexpected. I knew there was never going to be a moment like that again. People would always ask about Pat's sex, and I didn't have an answer. To me, Pat, by that point, had sort of taken on its own personality. It's almost like I was... oh, this sounds really actory, but I felt like I was just playing Pat. Pat was this other person. And I didn't know Pat's gender either. It was more like I had channeled this person than created it.
Dana Carvey, cast member. Most of the writers want to be performers, but I was naive, I didn't know that. So there was this creative tension between writers and performers. But you made alliances. It had all the resident political machinations of any large bureaucracy. You found writers who were sort of symbiotic with what your sensibilities were, and you worked with them. It was good to write with people who had Lorne's ear and could go into the special meeting where the sketches were picked. Toward the last couple years, I hooked up with Robert Smigel, and I'd go around the office doing Johnny Carson. Not the Rich Little version, which I thought was great, but that's funny stuff. You're a funny young man. Will you come back and see us again sometime? I think Johnny said that to me every single time I was on his show. Robert picked up on that, and we wrote a sketch. He's a brilliant writer. Johnny liked some of the sketches we did. The one that was called Carcinio he liked because he saw we were poking fun at Arsenio Hall as much as at him. There was one that I thought was kind of mean. It portrayed Johnny as senile and out of touch, and that one I just regret because it wasn't my intent. When you play Carson, when I was in the moment with Phil, what really comes through you is sort of just charm, just incredible likability and charm. He never really patronized a guest, and that's why he could sit out there with a 5-year-old or 100-year-old and really make it work.
Jan Hooks, cast member. I remember during the Gulf War when we were all so terrified. They had security guards with earphones in the studio who were packing lead and all this stuff. There were even bomb threats. Phil and I had a sketch, and I just looked at him and said, I'm not doing it. I'm not going out there. I can't go out there. And Bonnie Turner came up and said, now come on, you're with Phil. Phil just offered his arm, and I went out with him.